Thank you for coming. So today, we've been talking about like in the two previous seminars that you can watch online. So this is going to be kind of self-standing, not referring to them too much. But I've been theming this a little bit around the three main extensions of traditional cognition or traditional cognitive science that I have been mainly working on. Not because they might be. I mean, of course, I agree, or I think that they are the most important extensions, but might not be universally shared. So we've been talking about social minds, so extending the view of the mind that we study to be just like this one isolated thing, that and challenging the idea that we can learn, or that we have to learn about how the minds work if we just kind of keep on looking at individual minds. Instead, we've been arguing that the whole point of minds being how they are is that they interact with each other. So the whole point of having a mind is to be able to interact with other minds. And so in order to study how it works, we also need to study the mind in this kind of real life, real work, real time interaction. And I think I'm not sure if I really emphasized, but it's the temporal aspect, the time, real-time aspect is very important. There's so much information going on in between people when we are interacting, that kind of capturing that moment-to-moment dynamics of the process is very important. That was more or less kind of the leading theme or starting point for the second seminar, where we talked about dynamic minds. So again, in traditional cognition, there is a tendency to kind of collect, when we are collecting information, when we are collecting data on people, we are more or less collecting like static snapshots, kind of general qualities like your reaction times or your personality type or your score on this test or that test, state of your brain on that day. And again, we are arguing that this dynamic, once you start unpacking the temporal dimension, you get, even using the same old boring measurement tools that you've done, you kind of get to more interesting things, and you start to learn how things actually work. This is, of course, in interaction, this is of major consequence, and this is of major importance. There's so much, and I talked about mutual adaptation, which is this phenomenon or describes nicely what happens in an interaction, that continuously, in order to maintain an open channel of communication, in order to maintain synchronicity, that we need to be able to play music together or to dance together, we need to be able to constantly adapt to each other. So there's no, it's not just like a process that we set in motion in the beginning and then like kind of hope that everything flows to the end of the interaction smoothly, but it's like we are constantly checking that. And I showed some data that I think nicely illustrate that in order to be synchronous with someone, you basically need this continuous, tiny little adaptations. And this is from research on temporal interactions, research on synchronization and entrainment. We know that much of this adaptation is subconscious, it's automatic. And it's something we don't need to focus on. And it's again, I think to me, speaks about the primacy of this kind of social mind, that this kind of process, which is not unique to humans as animals, but is sort of relatively rare in the animal kingdom, for it to be kind of not only that we possess this ability, but that we possess such automaticity of it, that it's so automatic, and to me it tells that it's a very fundamental cognitive mechanism. I'm going to be talking about, or we can discuss that more today. I'll be sharing, or I kind of want to have your opinions about Vittorio Gallese's model on how all these things work on a kind of architectural level in cognition. So, having the fun part of social and dynamic mind. Then I wanted to talk about embodied minds, and as I already was spoiling this a bit last time and the first time, this is maybe the most traditional one. This is the kind of first extension to traditional cognition that appeared. But perhaps because people have been going on with this for so long, and so many different kinds of people have been going on at this for so long, I don't know, I no longer understand what embodied means. That's your interpretation, and then there's 1 million others, and they all come with scientific references. So that's very difficult to say what is the kind of core of this concept. So I was hoping that I would have like not kind of this worldly definition, like, you know, the definition to end all definitions of embodied minds, but maybe an interpretation from our research project, how we see embodied and embodiment and I don't have it in words. I think that we understand what we mean by it, and we have kind of a, it's not like we are in the dark and oh my God, we need to, like, first thing tomorrow we have to figure out what embodied means. It's rather that we seem to agree on how important and how automatic it is. So instead of me having it in words, we can all have a go at one of our experiments. And with that, I think it's kind of, we get our own kind of experience of the kind of embodied interaction that we are studying, and maybe that leads to, again, if not in words, in conclusion, but maybe for all of us, it kind of a kind of an understanding of what we mean by this. So, but first, I'll show you a few. Before we get to that, we will endure through some slides. And some studies that we've done before. So I have a few illustrations that couple of studies that we've done. Two of them kind of nicely, solidly published. One of them a little bit kind of in between. That I think kind of illustrates sides of embodied cognition that could be interesting or important. So. Let's go, and please interrupt me if you have questions or if you have comments or anything. So it doesn't need to be a monologue. Okay, so I can be reached. I'll be here until the end of the month, or basically until the evening of 28th. But if you have any questions, comments, anything, you can follow me on Twitter and retweet the Suorana Labrasta stuff that I've sent, a picture of all of you. I have a blog which I have trouble updating, but I'll try occasionally. So we are on the last part of the seminar series, and here's a couple of questions that just maybe put there. So the one thing about embodied cognition that more or less everyone agrees, and again, some people might not fundamentally understand what it's about, judging by how they do embodied cognition. But the idea basically is that body is seen as having a constitutive role. Like in all of the extended or 4 E's, inactive, embedded, embodied, extended, in all of these we see that it's not just like body is not just a backdrop, it's not just a context. It's not just the source of inputs and the kind of vehicle for outputs, but it's actually something that's in the same system, and the system constitutes of not just the brain but the body that it's in, and all the interactions and all the dynamics within, and the cognition, the information processing, even if you want to go all the way to traditional cognitive science and talk about representations. Which I recommend not to, but if you want, you can. But even they are kind of conditioned on the way that our body is. So our body provides shape and content to the mental representations and the way that the brain processes information. So this kind of arguing that there's almost very little point in looking at the mind if it's not in a context where the body can take part. Of course, we have experiments, we have neuroscience, we have brain imaging and everything which kind of makes this very difficult, and if you are lying still in a scanner having your brain scanned, and the experimenter tells you try to not to move so that we get a good image of your brain, then it's you can't be very embodied. in that. So, but this again, there's nothing wrong with that because no researcher can kind of just decide not to take that into account. You know, it's a limitation of the fundamental limitation of the measurements system. I think all you need to do is to be aware that you are measuring something that is of a limited scope, and this is something that often gets lost. But as I mentioned, like some examples in the first lecture, the so-called or the first seminar, that the so-called proponents of this so-called traditional cognition, which is like a big straw man that we have conjured, like anyone who's doing extended cognition is kind of has this traditional cognition, which is like this scary spooky boogeyman in the corner that's kind of limiting everything too much. That we discuss how that boogeyman doesn't necessarily exist, and that people who are doing the kind of so-called traditional cognition might be very, very aware of all the kind of extensions of cognition being very, very important. They just think that for them, the traditional thing, like for instance, some language-related stuff, might be just the most interesting thing in cognition. So they want to study that and ignore the body and ignore the extensions and embeddedness and inaction and stuff. Fair enough. So one kind of problem I have is that not all people understand this, or kind of people seem to, like, anything that has to do with the body, even if it's like you lying in a scanner and seeing a body on a screen, is embodied cognition. And so that's why the term has kind of diluted, because it's been used and overused so much. So the question maybe is that if you want to extend cognition, do you need to go, you know, to all four E's? Do you need to take all of them, or can you just pick? Like, oh, four E's is a bit too much. I'll take one, maybe two. Let's do embedded and extended, or just like, you know, embodied and inactive. That's enough. Like, again, this is a philosophical question. Probably some people argue that you either go all the way or then you are, you know, not valid, but maybe we can think about it. Okay, then I have some data. Should we talk about data and experiments? So let's see if we have. So this is sounds are coming now from my. So here's some embodiment. So you can pick whether you want to be the person on the second from the right or second from the left. On the bottom row, there's a nice contrast. So this is these are visualizations of motion capture data collected in Jyväskylä. This is a study by Petri Toivian, who's the professor there, Mark Thompson and Jeff Luck. I think lately Birgitta Burger has been working on the same data set. So here they, I think we can at least do that. so it doesn't, we don't get too embodied and distracted. So here the task, they have been doing research on what they call spontaneous movement to music, otherwise known as dance. but their term is, of course, it's more accurate, or it's kind of more exact. So they've been inviting people over to the motion lab. This was one example of a piece of music that they were playing. Participants would be wearing this kind of a Lycra jacket and pants where you can attach reflecting markers to joints so that they can measure their body movements in three dimensions and then make these animations and visualizations, but also study all the kinematics of their movements. So looking at different joints and joint angles and velocities and accelerations and of their different body parts and distances between body parts and like very, very basic measurements, basic metrics. But the point of the study is that they collect a lot of them. So from this, they see for each marker, they see it 120 times every second. So it's quite nice temporal resolution. Spatially, they can position each marker to within about 1 millimeter in space, so it's also spatially quite accurate. And they have here, I think in this representation, there might be 21 markers, if I don't remember wrong. So for 21 markers, three spatial dimensions, positions, velocities, accelerations, maybe occasionally even the kind of third time derivative of position, which is jerk, so the jerkiness of the movements. And then kind of posture related aspects like distances between certain joints and some angles, joint angles and things like that. So they've done a lot of research on this, a lot of papers from this data set alone. So in addition to asking people to move along the music in the way that they feel comfortable, like there's been a bit of a warm up and then you hear music and then you're just moving to it, dancing like you would be in a disco or something. They also had like the personality inventory, so they have their big five personality traits and some other background variables like how much they have musical experience or dancing experience and all kinds of things. And so what you can do with that kind of a data set, you can then start kind of matching. So all the kinematic variables that they measure and collect, they are a way of kind of describing what we see kind of as human beings, we see as movement qualities and funny things and you know, skillful things and all those kinds of things. Sorry?
There are specific rhythms.
Yeah. So everything that we quite readily and it's an example of how embodied we are, that from those we can map directly onto our own bodies how it would feel to dance like that, and we get this we pick the emotion, like the guy here is a little bit worried, like what's going to happen. It's like I would be there, kind of wondering if I, you know, not really a dancer, what should I do? Like, and then someone else who's like, you know, this is so cool, and da da da. And so we kind of just looking at those, we kind of automatically have an idea of their personality, their emotional. So we read their minds just by looking at that, mm-hmm. to some degree. And so this is something that they wanted to study. So to represent that movement, we have this number of kinematic features, and then we can correlate them, we can process them, compress them, like get the kind of squeeze out kind of the important variables, like principal components of that of those movements, and then correlate that with personality inventories and things, and then we can show those animations to other people and ask them to guess the personalities or emotional states, or then ask whoever was rating, ask for their personality traits and kind of match them. So they've been doing these kinds of combinations of movement and personality and musical genre and things like that in their papers. So it's quite interesting. I think for me, the one kind of exciting thing about this kind of data is that even though you only see the stick figure outlined, you can read a lot about the person. Like you might be wrong, but you kind of feel that you know quite a lot about the person. And this is something in psychology, it's been done quite a lot of for a long time already before motion capture systems, with point light displays. So people are kind of, actors are making movements in a black room in black clothes, and then you just have like a light somewhere in your collar or in your cuffs or ankles, and then or some white spot, and so you can get this video where you only have like joints visible, and then you ask people to kind of guess the gender or age or something, some other variables about the person. They've even shown that you can, if the point light displays of someone walking in, picking up a box, they can guess how heavy that box is. And also if the guy or girl who's coming in and picking up the box is faking that it's heavy, like, you know, it's actually light, but they fake it's heavy, they can spot the fake already, just like it from the point light. So that's, And if you have a limited number of people, let's say that, you know, your colleagues at the office, you know them very well, you know that it's one of those five people and you have to guess which one in your office is this point light display, when they are walking, you'll know. So it's kind of, this is an example of the kind of social information that we are very sensitive to, and we pick very readily from other people without even really being aware of. Okay.
Just out of curiosity, yeah. This experiment, was it a social experiment? Were there numerous people dancing at the same time?
No, one at a time. One at a time, yeah. So this is another kind of piece of magic that is then available once you have this motion capture data, that is easy then. I have just a selection of their stick figures, but they have more people, more participants, and then of course you can, if you have a certain feature in the music that you kind of numerically from the statistics that you've extracted, then you can reorganize everyone like based on that statistic, and then kind of plot them and then see what it actually does. And so it kind of a quick way of validating that what you are extracting from the data is something that is also perceptually salient. So this is a good way of going there. So we've done. So this is a study where I wasn't involved, but I worked with these guys. I worked in Jyväskylä for a number of years. And so one of the studies that we got to do when we were there is this choir workshop. Again, so this is a South African choir visiting Finland, and it's a kind of a Emmanuel Lutheran choir of South Africa, and we organized a workshop where the South African choir members were mainly teaching Finnish choir singers their style. So they are singing various types. So they are singing mainly folk songs or kind of arranged folk songs from various South African music cultures. So kind of across boundaries in South Africa, and their performances are very lively because every song is not just song. It's not just a song, but it also comes with a choreography. So they do. At the minimum, it's like everyone kind of swinging and kind of dancing while they're singing, but it goes to kind of having like almost play-like choreographies with soloists coming up and doing kind of things and everything. So this is something that the Finnish choir definitely isn't used to. So the Finnish choir they perform, again, all of them are very experienced choir singers, but they perform typical Western material, and when they perform, they have like their music in a music stand like this, or they're just standing like this. So minimum movement usually. So that was interesting to see for us, like how do they get to this kind of a different way of expressing themselves in a choir. So we did 2 days of a workshop. Every now and again, we motion captured them in some combination of participants. We also did interviews and things to learn more about how they see rhythm, how they see their performance. But what I'm going to show here is just a very simple snippet. So this is we are mocapping 8 people at a time. They have these markers on their feet and their heads. We couldn't have more markers per person because they stand in each other's way. So even though we have 8 cameras all around the room, there's still kind of each marker has to be seen by at least 3 cameras to get a good triangulation of their position. So that's for this kind of a tight arrangement, it's going to be a bit difficult. I hope I have the video here. I do. So now we need a little bit of. So the song is about sweeping. So the whole choir is there in the room, or everyone in the workshop, everyone's singing. It's only the bunch of people that are here in the center on the carpet that are motion captured. Okay. And then, so one thing that we were looking at, we were now looking at data from the two people in the front row. So the Finnish girl and then this South African girl who were standing next to each other. And we were plotting, we are now here plotting, plotting all of the three markers. Excuse me. So this is just looking at the acceleration of them in the vertical dimension. And so from the bottom there's right foot, left foot, and then heads. And so first thing to notice is that the feet trajectories of the feet patterns are exactly the same. So that's an easy part of the choreography to learn. That's basically so this is just from a short sample of the data. So this is here, if you are teaching this choreography to someone, the first thing that you teach is that, okay, so you take these steps back and forth. That's what you do. So for the Finn trying to learn this, that's okay, steps back and forth. So, and that's a relatively easy thing. And then when you have the music with it, then you can do it in time. No problem, as we can see. So it's like there's really no difference between the novice and the expert in terms of how their feet are moving. However, if you look at the head movements, we see quite a lot of difference. So for the novice, there's a peak in the head movement or the head up and down bobbing basically every time their foot hits the floor. So it's like it's basically just integrating, like kind of making a sum of what's happening in the feet. It's kind of summed up in the head movement. So this is our stiff fins hypothesis. That we can just like physicists are kind of hypothesizing that let's assume a spherical cow. We are basically assuming that there's a stiff rod between the head and the feet, and that's how the dynamics work in here. So everything that's happening in the foot is kind of just transferred directly in the movement of the head, and there's nothing going on in between. However, in the expert, so the South African dancer, they are doing something completely different in the middle part of the body. So it's not a linear combination of their feet going up. There's added stuff.
So could it be constrained by the fact that the novice has to check through eye gaze what is done, and so it prevents them to be focused on the choreography, and just by checking they have to keep their head in a certain position?
That's possible. That's possible. There's definitely it's clear from this that the focus is on the steps, just kind of remembering that and kind of not making sure I don't screw up this part. If we break down what the expert is actually doing, so we see that for the novice there's just one metrical level, so it's on this beat level that their feet are going. For the expert we see two or even three metrical levels. So there is this kind of the same kind of beat level pattern, but there's also patterns that are faster than the beat level, and then there's this overall pattern of up down, which is on a higher metrical hierarchy. So kind of.
And the expert has a better grouping. Balance from left and right. He's more doing the same movement on the right foot and left foot. At the beginner who has a different
It's a little bit broken down the pattern there as well. So this is and then when we asked the South African, so we were talking about the choir leader especially, whom you saw in front of the choir, and asking about how they, so what's the approach, or what's the kind of his thoughts about rhythm and movement in this. And then he explains, and this is to anyone who's looked at let's say popular music or African music or something like that, it's not a surprise. They describe how everything starts in the hips. That is, hip movement is the first thing, and then you add stuff. And in that sense, it kind of goes together with this, that there is this hip movement, and then what's happening in the feet is not directly kind of reflected in the head movement, but there is this kind of flexible thing in between that's kind of transmitting only some of it up, and there's other things going on as well. So that the kind of thinking that in the we could kind of simplify this as that the Finnish participant is thinking about their feet and the African South African participant is thinking about their hips when they're doing this. So that's a gross simplification, but I think this in general shows something that is also interesting for our future studies. A phenomenon that has been and it's linked to these levels of metrical hierarchy that are visible and present in the measured data. So this is something that is going to be interesting for us, or something we discussed yesterday on how to look into this in our research. This is Julien Laroche who's working with us. He's a musician and in music education and measuring entrainment and musical interactions, and he's he told us of this of his experience and experiment where just like the task was to kind of move your hand with a Nintendo Wiimote, which has an accelerometer, and move that to music, and you could already from that kind of decompose multiple metrical hierarchies in this very from this very simple movement. So that's for us it's an interesting question when we see this kind of a big difference between experts and novices. It's an interesting question on how do you get from the novice state into the expert state. What's the path from one to another, and the kind of learning that needs to take place, the kind of embodiment of rhythm that allows you to have this richer. So this might not be the kind of the, you know, the lots of gaps in the logic, but that on kind of on a general level, that's one of the ideas that we would be interested in looking at.
To add an ingredient, and I think actually the choir is a very nice case is the jointness of this kind of musical dancing experience to music,
right,
that we are very interested. So one thing is you're at home with a Wii kind of moving to music and slowly learning to dance, or maybe even in front of a YouTube clip. The other thing is what happens when you're with other people and how learning, like how to model like the dynamics of learning through interaction. So Julien, they're actually at a music school, music system that works with this kind of very interactive approach between the teacher and the Kadosh system, but the but we are of course interested even in context of not hierarchical learning. So when a group of people are moving together, how they learn together, it touches a little bit what we're going to do later today.
Yeah. Okay. So here, I think what we put in text we already mentioned this. Okay, then I think I'll go to skip forward a bit and go to the social emotions. I want to talk about that, and then we can have maybe enough time for the study. So I'll go here, and this is because on the first seminar we already talked about this study to some degree. So I'll explain the study first. I'll get a better picture that I can explain it with. No, that's okay. So social emotions is a 2-year project that we did to study communication and bodily expression of emotions in contemporary dance. So this was a collaboration between me and a couple of other scientists and then 2 contemporary dance choreographer dancers. The project in short the aim of the project was to combine artistic and scientific approaches and methods, like us five working as a community of practice to kind of figure out how emotions work in the context of contemporary dance. And it had multiple steps along the way. The first step, which I'll be talking a little bit today, is that Johanna and Jarkko, our two dancers, were in a dance studio figuring out how different emotions are represented in the body. So if you and how these emotions and these body states influence their interactions and their way and their movements. So this was the first part, kind of basic research on emotions in a social setting in the context of contemporary dance. So this is of course for both being professional dancers. Jarkko previously in the Scottish National Ballet, and Johanna at that time still full time in the Finnish National Ballet. Now currently both of them are freelancers already. They would of course already have like a good idea on how to express emotions in movement and all that, but they just wanted to kind of go back to square one and kind of figure it out. Took a long list of emotions. For each emotion, working through this kind of a checklist on where it comes from and all that. So that's part one. Part two was that we then together decided on which emotions to pick for further study, and we took ones that we called love and loathing, or love and hate. So love being a very positive emotion and a very active emotion, so kind of high arousal, high valence, if we think about these two emotional dimensions, high on both accounts. And loathing being the kind of opposite of that, so being very, very negative, but instead of being the kind of hate that is aggressive, it's the negative or kind of low arousal kind of, this kind of more like this kind of loathing. So kind of a self-directed rather than kind of aggressive, you know, angry type of hating. So nice polar opposites in a sense, both having a kind of story behind. And so what we did next was then Jarkko and Johanna made up a short choreography. The loop was about 20 to 30 seconds, and then they were practicing it so that they could loop it together 7 times. And within those 7 loops, they could go from the extreme of loathing to the extreme of loving, or just stay in the hating all the time, or stay in the loving all the time, or be neutral in between, or move from neutral to loving, neutral to hating and all that. So all these combinations, just using those two main emotions and the neutral that's halfway through, and then kind of learning how to transition from one to another during this choreography. So the choreography they made us graciously had all the design features that we wanted to have in the in terms of the motion capture study, but never dared to ask. So it was their idea that they would only have one choreography that they would then make so that the choreography would be always the same, but it would be kind of to begin with, it would be as neutral as a choreography can be, so that they can make the same essentially the same movements both in the loathing and loving state. So that was already kind of an achievement. And then also having it so that it's a duet, but that the two dancers never touch each other, so that we can then, if needed, we can then replace, like from the in the stick figure stage, we can then replace one character with another character from another take. So that was another at that time an important thing. So I'll just show what we got that far. So there's the green character is having this positive emotion, and the blue character is having the negative, so loving and loathing. And so there's it might take a few rounds of watching this to figure out that they're actually doing the same movements, because they look so different. And then because the loving one is so much faster, then we had this kind of a holding pattern for the faster dancer to wait for this slower one to come to the end of the loop so that each loop would always be synchronized. Otherwise, if we do seven loops and in every loop the other one is 10 seconds faster, then they are kind of, they've already had their coffee before the other one's even finished. So that was a way of kind of keeping things in check. So what we did with this is to do more or less the same kind of an analysis that Petri and Jeff and Mark did in Jyväskylä. So extract a lot of kinematic features, velocities, accelerations, angles, distances and stuff. And then do a study of them and kind of see what kinematic features link to which emotion and how. So for that we did like a principal component analysis, which was kind of truncated, reducing the dimensions. So we had initially like something like 300 different kinematic features, and then we squeezed them down into two components. So the one component basically captures the loving to loathing, so the emotional dimension, and the other component captures whether they are doing the same thing or a different thing. So the kind of emotion and social are basically the two dimensions in this data. And as you already saw directly that pretty much like the kinematic features that explain the loving movement are ones that have to do with velocity and acceleration. So whenever there's high velocity, high acceleration is very likely to be the loving one. The loading one is much more slower. There's also very, as you can see, but we are happy that we can also be able to find that in the numbers, because there's so many numbers that and so much data that it can be an issue of, it's not an issue of having data, but it's an issue of being able to detect from that data something that's meaningful. And so what we were happy to be able to do is to kind of map not only these velocity and acceleration patterns, but also postural patterns. So as you can see from the still photo, there's also already a big difference in how the other one is totally open, totally kind of upright, even longer than he usually is. And then Johanna, who's doing playing the loading one, is even shorter than she usually is. And it's kind of slouched and inside and kind of all like that. So this is coming, the data analysis for this was done by Klaus Ferger, who's been working with ASAF and in our EC project as well. And this was based on what he did in his PhD, which was basically exactly this, but in different types of data. So looking at people walking or looking at people doing everyday things like knocking on doors and things. So he developed a system where you can extract emotional kinematic components of movement data, knowing what, you know, having examples of different emotions and different ways of doing so. Having an angry walk, having an elated walk, having a kind of a eye on the world type of walk, or, you know, walking, skipping, limping kind of things. Extracting those kinematic features and then having a neutral template, and that you can then, and he's made a nice application that you can use even online, where you can put like, you know, 20% of angriness into this movement, and then let's put 50% limping, and so you can kind of modify neutral movement to whatever direction you want. And this is coming from the context of computer game development, where this is of course very useful. But if you have a character in a computer game, you only need to do this expensive and time-consuming motion capture of that actor who's doing the character once, and then whenever, depending on what the player is doing, the character needs to be able to respond adequately. You can just kind of color their movements with the emotions that the player's actions have generated. So this is coming.
For extracting emotions and what you found, is there an articulation with speaking more than the other one about emotion?
So speaking,
which is more significant from one emotion to one other, but which is always in a certain range of move, which could be an expression of emotion, whatever the emotion is, or you found, for example, for happiness, a part of the body which is moving each time more in every participant, or is there different from one people to one other?
Well, in our study, in this one, we only had these two dancers, so we don't have more data from other people. In Klaus's study, I think there were specific specific body parts, like in that, and specific ways in the posture, and things would be changed to go from aggression to neutral or to happy. But I don't, it's Klaus's study, so I don't remember the details exactly.
Just following on from that, from what I understood, you said the principal components analysis showed that most of the variability was along two components.
Yeah.
The primary one being according to the emotion, which was associated with velocity and acceleration. The second one being more movement.
The second one being social. So to what extent are the two characters moving, doing the similar or different stuff? So that's because there's the PCA was done in a kind of very crude fashion, so that we didn't tell, like we just basically put the two-person data into one bunch in there. So there's like, you know, all the system doesn't know what's coming from what, but it basically what it detects then is that if you're having a data set where like half the metrics are very high and half the metrics are very low, then you put it into a different place. So that's basically what the second principal component is detecting, that there's a huge difference between the two characters. And what was interesting, like both principal components were very kind of predictable and nice, and I don't have them on the slide. I have it on the slide, but it's not in this presentation. I'll add it before I add the presentation online, so you can check it from there. So what is interesting there was to see how well, because we are in the PCA, we put basically each individual loop. So each performance that they did was seven loops. So, and the seven loops was basically like during that seven loops, they would go, for instance, from neutral to love or from love to hate. So what is interesting to see is that if we trace these individual loops that belong to the same performance, and we trace them in this two-dimensional space, we see very, very linear progressions. That is kind of my, you know, well dancers kind of a thing that they have, like to their professionalism and how they can kind of change like with equal steps. Like you have seven loops of this thing and they go from one extreme to another, and they manage to do that in equal steps as far as we can measure. That, you know, that's really impressive to me. And it's also like the way that things align even without any kind of specific rotation of the data or any other filtering or any other kind of voodoo. Everything kind of lines up very kind of orthogonally into the, so everything is kind of nicely aligned. So it's kind of, we have the neutrals are in the center, and then it's kind of, we go to both extremes equally far, and so on and so forth. So it's a very nice and symmetric along both dimensions. The picture, which again maybe tells that that primarily to me it tells that these guys have done an excellent job in kind of figuring out how exactly to adjust these parameters in their own movement. So that was very nice.
And in Klaus's study, when they were looking more at daily life activity and daily life movements, was there still an association between the emotional component and, say, the velocity and the acceleration?
So it's a more complicated picture, of course, because the differences are more subtle. So here everything is quite, which is one of the reasons why we took contemporary dance, because everything is so exaggerated. So you have to do that to kind of convey the emotions from the stage to the audience. So I think that's just like, to us, like that's a perfect lab for this. Like, please exaggerate all you want. That's perfect. Especially in the first stage, when we then get kind of nice calibration of our measures and everything. So for us, it's a very, I think it's a more kind of simpler picture. I think I can kind of, when I'm saying that it's about velocity and acceleration and then being large or small, I think that's a fair description of what the first PC does. There's of course more detail, but that's the kind of main gist of it. for Klaus's other stuff, I think it's a more complicated issue because they are also looking at, he's looking at more like more emotions within the same type of movement, more dimensions in that sense, and they are all like, you know, okay, you have your angry stomping and then you have your kind of neutral walking and then you have your kind of this kind of I own the whole world. So there's this very kind of stereotypical big movement differences that you get for your posture and which parts of your body are moving more or less. Like the aggression is very kind of up down, lots of huge accelerations. The body is swinging, upper body is swinging kind of side by side in this kind of king of the world walk. So there are these characteristics, but it's a more, again, I don't remember exactly what's kind of under the hood in Klaus's system. I think it's like a PCA based thing, but there might be more components and all that, because then what he's done is this kind of extra layer where you're not only just kind of measuring stuff from measured data, but you can synthesize new data. So you can take the neutral movement and you can add to that, kind of tweak those features like to a direction that makes it look more like aggressive, makes it look more. And it's a very very convincing demonstration that he's done there. So for us, the next part of the study was what I discussed in the first seminar, which is a perceptual study. So we were showing these stick figures to participants who were rating, not trying to guess which emotion it was, but they were rating it on the three-dimensional emotional model. So looking, basically rating the arousal, like the activity, level of activity, valence, like negative, positive, and then the dominance, which is kind of whether this person is leading or lagging. So the participants were always rating just one of the two characters. And then what we discussed in the first seminar was that when we look at those ratings, we can then from them we can see that okay, sorry, I need to go back one step and say that, okay, when we're preparing the stimulus set for that perceptual experiment, we did one sort of sneaky thing that experimenters often do. So we were replacing, we are using half of the stimuli were the original loops, just like you saw, and half of them were doctored ones, where we replaced one of the dancers and with an example from of the opposite emotion that was there originally. So if we had like if the original one was both participants are loving, we replaced one of the characters to something that was someone who was hating at the time. So we had love hate, like we kind of from similar to maximal contrast, and we did that to both kind of love and to hate. And when we are comparing participants' ratings, so we were always replacing the one that they weren't rating, so the kind of context person basically. And when we compare what people rated, we saw that there was a big difference in, even though the character that they were rating was physically the same, there was a big difference in their rating of that because of the other person had been changed from the equation. And this we interpreted meaning that in order to perceive emotion from this kind of display, whatever the other person is doing is influencing how we do that. So in order to really detect and see that the blue character here is kind of loathing and suffering, it's really accentuated when you see the green character who's kind of all joyous and kind of. So the contrast between the characters is kind of enhancing or kind of strengthening your interpretation that this is actually a very negative emotion. So that's. And a similar effect on all three dimensions. So whether we are talking about level of activity, positive or negative emotion, or then the person being a leader or a follower. So that was one side. And then now we get to the fun part of the project. So and this is what I wanted to talk more about today. So instead of just focusing on kind of scientific outputs in the project, we focused and completed the artistic outcome of the project. There are two artistic outcomes, and I'll talk about both in some incoherent order. Maybe I'll talk about the final performance first. Until now, we had only on our artistic team, we had only Jarkko and Johanna, and they had basically done their own work in a dance studio and then produced just this one choreography that you just saw. So like 20 seconds of movement material. Then always the idea was that we have to, once we have learned what we have to learn about emotion expression and emotional communication, we put it out as a dance piece, like a performance, stage performance. And then Jarkko was the kind of artistic director of that, so he was coming up with concepts about this, and then at some point we felt that okay, we need music for this as well. Like this is the movement is okay, but it's quite subtle. If we put in music, then that will really kind of, it's music is a great amplifier of emotions. It kind of interprets whatever the artistic intention of the mover is much better. So we, Jarkko knows some people. Next thing we do, we have a composer willing to compose us musical material, just like Jarkko and Johanna are working on more and more movement material. And then what our composer did, he composed us music for two cellos. So we had two cellists. So now we have two dancers, two cellists, and music material, movement material, and then we start working. And this was really an interesting period. So what we figured and how we started doing this is that we form two pairs. So each dancer has a cellist. So there's like for one unit there's a kind of musical and movement output, basically. So we have two units that are interacting, and they kind of have these two modalities that they have in use. So we started working on emotion expression and all this. And then in the end, I'll tell the whole story first, and then we can go back to details. So in the end, we have a performance where we have like it's a duet for two dancers, two cellists, and one scientist. So I was the one scientist. I was on stage as well, not dancing, but I was behind my computer. And what I was doing, I was running a vote, an online vote about emotions. So we had the audience voting for emotional for different emotions that the performers should display. And the way we structured this is that there were three or four votes depending on how long we made this, like 15 to 20 minutes. The audience has a binary choice. So for they have two emotion words, and they have to pick one for pair one and pick another one from another pair of emotions. They pick one for pair two, and whichever emotion word in both of these votes gets more votes gets selected to be the starting point for pair one and pair two. So this could be let's say emotion one is happiness, so they are selecting between happy and sad. Happy wins, so pair one starts from happy. Pair two, sadness or indifference, they pick indifference. So our starting point is that pair one is happy, the pair two is indifferent. Same voting is repeated three or four times during the piece. However, the piece never stops. So once they start moving, once they start playing, it never stops, and they are not in no way tied to, or it's not like the emotion words that people are choosing, they are basically just signposts on the way. So it's not like, okay, now here's the vote result, now you have to switch to this emotion immediately. It's rather saying that this is where you're next supposed to be going. So One thing that we learned in this whole project, and one thing that I think we quite nicely displayed in this performance, is that emotions are changing all the time. So this would actually go to last week's seminar on dynamic minds, but it's, I can bring it up here. So emotions are changing all the time. After about 5 seconds of moving and playing, the happy and indifferent are already something else. It's like when you have such strong interaction, so you have two dancers picking up stuff from each other's movements, both dancers picking up stuff from basically both of the cellists, both cellists are picking up stuff from each other, and they are picking up stuff from the movers. So there's no one's leading, no one's following, that's not the thing. The thing is that both pairs are kind of organically together, influencing each other, of course. There's no primacy of either of them, so there's no, it's not that the cellist is kind of accompanying what the dancer is doing, following them. They are following the music, they are following the emotion, they are trying to kind of course, they are kind of, their primary aim is to be in emotional synchrony with their dancer, and the same with the dancer and the player, but this all gets a little bit murky.
Can you say they're picking up stuff? Can you be more specific?
Sorry?
When you say the cello cellist and the dancer are picking up stuff.
So they're picking up what the emotional intention might be. So we have, or what the emotion, what the reaction might be. So the two dancers are dancing together. So they are dancing a duet for most of the time. So they are influencing and interacting with each other. So for instance, when the indifferent dancer with their cellist playing an indifferent emotion meets this happy guy who wants to kind of make acquaintance, comes close, and they react to that somehow. So I don't really care, but this guy is onto me. So what do I do? The cellist is picking up what the dancer would, how they would react. But before that, already the cellist might have reacted to what the other cellist is playing. So it's kind of a network of things. But it's those kinds of emotional cues. Either movement cues, things that happen in the interaction, or then kind of feed from the emotion words that we are choosing as the audience. So the emotion words are important because they give us a kind of a drama for this. So we start from like a starting point emotion, so am I happy or sad or meh? And then the second one, in the second vote, it's emotions that have to do with kind of social emotions, basically. So am I interested or am I kind of repulsed or something like that? And then we get kind of that sort of, so that the audience kind of gives an instruction on where this relationship should be going. Like is it kind of positive, negative, closer, further? And then when we get to the third vote, and this is already like, you know, because everything is changing all the time, we are already quite far in this interaction. So in the third world, it's basically this kind of, we choose which climax we want. So there can be kind of, you know, absolute love or ecstasy or really strong hate or anger. So we kind of, the biggest emotions are there in the third world. And then, you know, we see what happens with that, like there's big explosions and everything. And then it has repercussions and things kind of, go on, and then the final vote that comes, the selection that the audience has is more about kind of this kind of concluding emotion, that am I disappointed, you know, like disappointment, satisfaction, da da da, these kinds of things. That so for each vote we have like a different set of emotion words to choose from, and they are kind of developed so that the whole thing forms like a logical dramaturgical arc. But then the interesting thing, and now I'll show you a little bit of which we maybe can hear as well. So here's a trailer for our piece. If you want to get us to perform, there's a website with a price on it, so we'll come if you book us a theater and stuff. Thank you. So musically, that was really like a fast forward of everything. But the kind of logic and structure of both music and movement is that it's at the same time improvised and pre-choreographed and pre-composed. So there are movement loops and there are musical loops, as you could hear that both cellists were playing essentially the same piece, but they have full freedom to color it in whichever they want. So articulation, tempo, they can leave out notes, they can just kind of do whatever. It's the most important thing is to express emotion with that through that material as best as you can. And same with the dancers, they have a choreographed movement, certain movement loops that they can combine. And both the composer and the choreographers have been spending some time thinking that every loop goes somewhat together with another loop, so that things are kind of harmonic in a sense. That there's otherwise there would be too much chaos. And so one, I'll just point out two points from the practice rehearsal periods of that I think are important things that at least to me were really kind of educational in the world of emotion. So the first one, and the first one is maybe a little bit more kind of I don't know what it's related to. It's maybe kind of performance planning or kind of maybe it's kind of a more general principle of perception, but our composer, first to our first rehearsal, he came with a thick pile of music. He had probably composed 32 pages of music already, different kinds of loops, different da-da-da-da-da. What's left after the rehearsal period is maybe two sheets. So there's one kind of thing that we learned that because there's so many things are changing all the time, naturally everything, the emotions and these interactions, when you have a dynamic interaction between four people and with the kind of premise that things are changing very fast and things are changing all the time. So that's, and for this to be followable from the outside, from the inside, it's all clear. But if you are on the outside, you have to have something, something that stays constant. So in this case, then we were simplifying both the movement and especially the music, so that the musical material is really it's only three or four different loops. So there's enough similarity in the musical material so that people can trace what is changing. So they can still identify this melody that you just heard, but they hear it five or six, seven different colors of it during the performance, so they can understand that okay, something's changed. That this is as before, but there's something changed. Not everything has changed, because if everything changes, there's no way you're just lost. Everything's changing all the time. I can't understand anything. However, if you have lots of similarity and variation in that similarity, that's a much more kind of gentler way of showing people that things are changing. And so that's one thing which is, I think, for anyone doing performing arts is probably already knows this. For me, this was an important kind of mental note to make. The other one, which I noticed that now that I'm thinking of, whenever we are doing emotion-related research, whenever I'm reading papers on emotion, I think my kind of scientific thinking of what emotions are and how they work has changed during this process and this project. So it definitely has solidified my understanding that emotions are social, that's the basic nature of emotions, that it's about the purpose of having emotions so that we have facial expressions and everything is about to broadcast our mental state. It's a way of helping other people read our minds. We are kind of, if I'm sad, if I'm hating you, if I'm about to hit you, if I'm loving you, about to kiss you or something, it's important for me that you can read what I'm intending. And so we have all these kind of systems to facilitate mind reading in social context, and reading emotional information is one of the most important. important ones for our survival. Mm-hmm. So
was it on purpose that the two dancers maintained physical contact? Was that a choice?
I think it was a choice for the trailer. For the actual performance, it varies. Mm-hmm. So they mostly they are like the idea is that it's about their relationship. So the physical contact or lack of physical contact is actually correlated with what kinds of emotions they have or the combination of their emotions. So it can be that one of them is chasing the other one, like the one would want to be close and the other one would anything but. And as you saw, like we got to some very kind of almost violent stages of aggression there in the trailer. So it changes also. So one of the, here I could actually back up and to the scientific, briefly to the artistic research on emotions that Jarkko and Johanna did. So what they were going through a list of emotion words, and for each emotion they were using Stanislavski methods, so kind of method acting thing. Going for a biographical memory of that emotion, trying to remember how it felt for them to be in that emotion, then seeing if I turn this emotion up to 11, what happens, and then with that kind of getting a hang of what this emotion means in the body, how it feels, verbal description of what this emotion does, and then in the social context. So if I'm with this person on stage, what does it mean? How far do I want to be of that person? Do I want to be oriented towards them or away from them? And these kinds of sort of characteristics. So they filled in like a matrix of emotions and characteristics that have to do with them. And then once the cellists joined the project, they did the same for music, like musical characteristics and emotion words. And this is all like there's of course in I know better the music research part, but there are matrices such as this have been constructed before in music. So like either from recorded music that have been labeled happy, sad, da da da, or in other ways. So we have an idea of what musical features are most typically kind of present in happy music or in sad music. What kind of articulation? What kind of tempo? What kind of tonality? And so on and so forth. But what they were doing it specifically for playing the cello and that type of music in that context. So it's kind of a slightly more narrow perspective. But at the same time, there are ways of playing the cello that you wouldn't normally kind of maybe use on stage so much. So they were kind of mapping those. So the range of expression is I think much wider than what you see in the other studies done on music, because they are typically kind of, let's say, Western classical music or Western popular music. So they're slightly kind of, sort of, compared to the emotional range that these guys were doing, it's usually maybe a little bit kind of on the kind of the midsection of those, and these guys were going kind of extremes on both ends. So that. The point of the matrices is that it could be an interesting and important teaching tool, and so definitely Jarkko and Johanna have been using it in their teaching, like teaching dance to people. They're already kind of exploiting this in their work. So coming back to whether it was a choice or not to be in contact in the stage, so depending on how what the emotion. What the emotional status is, yes, either, but the kind of focal point of the piece was their interaction. So everyone kind of watching that is kind of thinking, okay, so these guys, what's happening to them? Is it going to be a happy end? Is it going to be like, are they going to break up? What's going on? And that is the same actually goes then for the cellists and their music. So you can also think. That for the dancers touching each other is a strong kind of cue for the audience that okay, now there's something happening there. How do we do that in music? What's touching in music? What's not touching in music? And so that was again one in the practice period that we were looking at, and there of course like being on the same note or being kind of playing in the same similar type of expression or not, like both quiet, both loud, or same articulation, both playing legato, or the other one playing legato and the other one's kind of just like doing some really rippy pizzicato or something that clearly not touching. So that was one of the, and then in the rehearsal, or when we're doing these rehearsals, then my role was mainly to kind of be there on the sidelines, observe everything, and basically do the shout the emotions. Like I was doing the kind of role of the audience. Like we had quite early on, we decided that we want to have we want the audience to be involved. We felt that it's important. Not because it's really cool to have like a mobile phone, it's kind of fashionable, but I was actually more worried that it's going to be distracting, and initially didn't really want to do it necessarily, but then I was convinced that because these processes are so intricate, you have to be inside to really get what's going on. You have to be focused because they're changing so fast, so kind of the voting is then a way of putting your skin in the game, so to speak. So that it kind of gives you an insider perspective because you've chosen one element of the performance. So it gives you more ownership of what's going on, and maybe helps you kind of get involved and engaged. In the end, we managed to do it in a way that wasn't distracting, based on the second half of the final part of the performance, which was a conversation between the audience and the performers on stage, where we were explaining some of the details of our research project and kind of talking about how people felt in the audience and how they responded to it. To me, it was quite interesting that in the practice, when we were having these, that okay, let's do every 3 minutes, I will shout new emotions to both, and then we were doing this. And I would have the list of emotions, and I was just kind of picking there, like either at random or just beforehand making this list, and they didn't know what to expect. We decided that that's the best. And many times, this was both interesting and slightly frustrating, and I was kind of starting them off like, okay, happy, indifferent, and then they, I'm kind of waiting that my next one is going to be kind of, you know, interested and agitated or whatever. And then I'm watching them do, and during these 3 minutes, like they're already in my next emotions in like, you know, after 2 minutes, I'm like, damn it. And then they're already moving, like if I have like an angry and something, and like they are already like angry and something, and then they already made up, and then it's my next kind of call, and I'm kind of, you know, almost resetting them 1 minute back, like, okay, you are angry and you are this. And this happened many times, that they were kind of moving to the direction that I was kind of, I had planned, but they had a faster pace to get there. So that's for the actual performance. Again, like performers preferred not to know or think too much what's coming ahead. So they kind of preferred to have slightly kind of not be completely kind of in the knowledge of what's happening. So what we had for timing these, cueing these, and displaying the emotion words was we had projections, and for the projections then there was also an interesting kind of projection gimmick where we were tracing the dancers' movements on stage with a Kinect, and then Roberto Pugliese has also been working with some people here in Paris, was then live morphing the outlines of the dancers according to what their emotions were. So he had pre-programmed for every emotion word like a morphing of their outlines and the way that the characters were drawn, and this was then projected on the stage, both on back and on the floor. So really kind of an added illustrative dimension. Anyway, my final slide will be something that could be a description of Johannes and Jarkko's emotion matrix. So there if you take like how sadness is this increased pressure in your nostrils and in your chest, and it's like a total depression or kind of lack of energy in your limbs, and otherwise it's an empty emotion, and similar descriptions. And if you were to draw these on humans, it would look something like this. So if you look at the sadness, might not see the colors so well, but there's a red color on the chest indicating kind of increased pressure, and then on the face there's this yellow kind of really high activation, and then all the limbs are kind of negative, so kind of deactivation there. However, this is not from Jarkko's and Johanna's. This is from an international study where people were asked to draw on these human shapes. They were asked to draw where their body are more activated or less activated when they feel these emotions. And this has like thousands of respondents at the moment, and these are averages. This is from a paper in PNAS by Lauri Nummenmaa and others. So this is the correspondence between what Jarkko and Johanna found with their artistic method and what Lauri and others found using this method, and also some results we have from other motion capture studies, not by our group but other people who've been kind of mapping emotions to movements. There's a very high correspondence, so this is an interesting thing. I think we are kind of striking the what is sort of relatively universal in the.
And the color is the temperature of the body.
Color is the activation or deactivation of the body, so not temperature.
Activation.
Yeah. So where you if you have this feeling, where do you which part of the body feel more active than average, and which are more passive?
Do you know what did they measure to get the idea of activity?
This was just subjective, so participants were answering this by drawing on this. Shapes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's not body measurements, but it's just kind of people's feelings.
And finally, they didn't put hate.
Sorry.
They took love as an emotion, but they distinguished hate. There is no specific hate.
At least not in this picture. No. Yeah.
With right out love is not really an emotion. It's a need.
Maybe it's a verb, someone says it's a verb.
No, the difference is that an emotion is something that's coming and going, whether a need is necessary to survive. Without love, the human nature will die or whether run sick on the long term. But without disgust or surprise is a very, what I learned is surprise is the first. One of the first initial emotions. Wherever I have already an experience, every time I open the door, I take this cup, the first emotion is surprise, what kind of reality is. That's already a surprise. It's not a surprise in a larger cognitive interpretation. It's just a very pragmatic a movement.
There's this distinction between emotion and feeling and all that. But
and hate is mostly a paradox.
Do you relate that drawings with movement of what you did see with dancing?
Yeah, so there, from what Jarkko and Johanna detected, or what they wrote in their matrix, corresponds pretty well with what we see here. So of course they did it in the contemporary dance context, but if we take that, and they had all this kind of proximity and orientation and things like that, but if you just take the how does this emotion feel in the body, so that they can on stage, they can go straight from the emotion word to the expression without having to go all through the biographical memory, blah, 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 but have the kind of a shortcut straight to the bodily expression, then that their descriptions match really, really nicely what's in here.
And this drawing has been done in Tulane University?
Yes.
Okay. I've seen it so many times on the internet that I didn't know where it's coming from.
Yeah.
I'm really glad to meet someone who has participated.
this is a first degree relationship with this, so I wasn't in this study, but it's my colleagues. Okay, should we do an experiment? Yes. Asaf, do you want to?
No.
No, me? Huh? Okay, I think you could help me. Mm-hmm. You could help me, okay.